Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight will be Travis Marsaut. I think most of you know Travis. The name of his, the title of his talk today will be The New Sincerity Mix.
7-1. Great. Thanks. All right. Thanks, Bonnie. Yeah, if you're as old as me, then you made cassette mixes. All right. Good to see you all tonight. Thank you. I'm up in Arnold, which is up in the Central Sierra. I have a cabin here I've had for about the last 10 years, and it's been wonderful with this shutdown because I've been able to spend time up here reconnecting with my family, with my dog. It's just wonderful. Can you all hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Great. So my talk tonight is about sincerity. And I hope and trust that you've had a wonderful holiday weekend, full of family fun and masks. Moreover, I hope that you reconnected with your own yin and yang. That was an email I got yesterday. This man, a financial planner that had gotten my email somehow through some kind of corporate snooping, Googled me, thought about it for 10 seconds and made some kind of gag. I think that's what religion's been reduced to for many people. Something they don't normally consider anymore as a potential way, as a path of redemption, or as a way to care for others. People don't really even consider the word. And in some circles, religion is a crutch. A way to make a buck or win fans. An elaborate, historically ancient form of charlatanism. That's a model. And here's another one. Self-expression dictates much of our culture. In our day-to-day lives, we are largely productive and oriented towards the light. Spending time, as I have in the forest in the last few months, you really start to notice how the trees that have access to light thrive and survive. Every tree has that biological imperative to grow towards the light. For a human, can I be completely committed in the development of a shiny new product that enables heretofore unimagined potential, that helps customers and is commercially successful. These last few months inside have been like longer nights. Not literally, you know, it's summer now, but I'm sleeping far, far better than I did in my day-to-day life in March. And that's probably presumptuous, but some of you know what I mean. Internally, we've had this winter of the soul. We're social creatures, and it's hard to be isolated. Canando's ordained students have been meeting during this last few months every week. Brenda has been leading most of that discussion. And last week, Brenda remarked that she thought that Zen was really a cowboy religion. I've been thinking about that since then and listening to the music of Beck. Both cowboys and astronauts. We had a scrub launch earlier today with SpaceX. Some of you might be familiar. Both cowboys and astronauts have a historic underpinning and a heroic underpinning, but both are not quite here in either time or space or practice. They're popular and entertaining manifestations, ongoing characterizations of social ideals that we can dig into tonight. So you might remember last week I asked Brenda, how should we go beyond models? And of course we can if we wish to remain silent. That's the conclusion of early Wittgenstein and most of the Zen Enlightenment stories that you may have heard. The finger pointing at the moon. That's a simple example. Yet, these frameworks are needed. These frameworks of how we think of the world are needed if we want to have any kind of advanced dialogue about cultures and societies. There's a historical era said to follow after modernity. Does anybody know what that is? I've never heard of anyone that wants to talk about this model ever. In fact, when Les was talking about the subtitle for his last book, it came up, but trust that I'm going to talk about sincerity tonight. Okay. If we are culturally insensitive, we open ourselves to being unwittingly cruel. Unwittingly cruel. Except if someone bullies you with their culture. And not understanding this point is like a carelessness born of perceptual limitations. You know, Carolina, who I practiced with for some years, she once gave me a ceramic moccasin, leather sandal. And she said, I have the other one. And on the sole, she had written, walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Same. That's what my daughter says. My daughter Alice, my younger daughter. It's at least two sides of the same coin. My family was up in the High Sierra over the weekend camping. And it's real cowboy terrain. So I'd like to take this opportunity to share my screen if you don't mind. So I had a few photos, but this gets the point across. This is a limestone formation near Mono Lake. And it was formed, at least on the outside, geologically, when Mono Lake was much bigger. And so it's sort of a blister on the seabed. And you can sort of see that, right? But it's also a door. And you can walk inside of it. And this is what cowboys did in the late 19th century. They carved out these what are called tufas, and they would spend the afternoons, you know, in when it was blazingly hot, just kind of watching over their cattle. And and to beat the heat. And, you know, I was up there on Sunday and I thought, wow, this is a much more humane kind of reality than the Westerns of my youth. Which would be like, you know, it'd be desert heat and the guy would be wearing like, a vest and fringe and stuff, you know? I think you know what I'm talking about. It's that Western ideal. Let's see. I guess I'll stop that now. But my family and I went inside that and hung out, and it was cooler. It was like 10 or 15 degrees cooler. It made me think of a cave, you know, a little miniature cave. Let's see. So I was kind of getting ready to talk about cowboys. There's a pair of dualistic moral norms called the white hat and the black hat. It's derived from those Westerns. And, you know, later that morning, Brenda's proposition had me thinking about this musician that I'm a fan of named Beck, and how I could use this opportunity to discuss culture through his music. And music itself is more of a dark art. At least I think so, when it's compelling. And that mix that I sent out to the group, which I can send to anyone who hasn't received it. There's a few Hootenanny songs in there, but it's mostly introspective. I think the really touching music closes our eyes and stills us. This postmodern perspective is wry observation and irony. I've had over a decade away from TV, and I recently found it again as a way to connect with my daughter, Lucy, who's 16 years old. And coming back to TV now after about 12 years or so has been tremendously insightful in how the culture has gradually shifted away from irony and towards sincerity. And it's a long metaphysical road back. And it can feel overwhelming. And to find my way through this experience, I've been very honest with myself. You know, if we can't be honest with ourselves, it will be difficult for us to be steady enough to endure and step into the lives we're capable of. So that's kind of what I've been thinking about for the last month or so. I walk my dog up here in the mountains, and I frequently notice the older folks in their houses watching Wheel of Fortune and old Seinfeld episodes from 30 years ago now. And the new TV show that Brea, Lucy, and I have been watching is called Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Is anybody familiar with that show? No? Okay. In many ways, it owes itself to that sort of zany uproariousness of Seinfeld, which I'm sure you know. But somewhere in the last 20 years, sincere lessons or growth in the characters has come back into favor. It's still deeply satirical and irreverent, but everyone respects and obeys the captain, Captain Holt. It's not that he's the star, That's Andy Samberg's character. But most of the characters, despite their limits and their flaws, they generally try to do good. They try to solve crime. And so in that way, the characters are redeeming. Each of us has a relationship with our own lives, even if it's uneasy or unproductive, even in the midst of sense pleasures or distractions. Even if you're the most incapable or incompetent person or the most accomplished entertainer of your generation. Homer Simpson, you know Homer Simpson. I think everyone knows Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson was the incompetent safety officer at the local nuclear power plant. But he had one redeeming quality. He loved his family. Zen plays out day and night in these endless phenomena. In that moment, and it's gone. Will you be there to meet it? That's the practice. And it's hard for me to find examples of that steadiness today. They're not promoted by the culture because they are virtue and not value-based. But I had the good fortune recently to read a book by Houston Smith to help me understand the cultural dilemma that we're in. It was called Why Religion Matters. And as Zen students, we learn about the difficulty of caring for people in ways they have never been cared for. In ways that they haven't been cared for themselves. And this may be really, really unsexy in our day-to-day lives, but on a wide open visual backdrop, the act of caring can appear as a panorama of heroic proportions. And I think that's what the good Westerns are. Today, there isn't a unified religious, philosophical, or scientific truth that attempts to explain everything. There's no unified theory for everyone. Yeah? I'd ask you to consider that. If you need some example, here are some relatively recent ones of failing, at least pluralistically failing ideals. Here we go. There is one true God who saves us through our faith in this knowledge. Leaders tend to be the best, brightest, and most capable of us. Change comes in the heritable characteristics of biological populations over successive generations. Workers should own the means of making their own products. History is a narrative arcing towards progress. And now the easy ones. Peace on earth. Love is all you need. Science will save us. Good will one day triumph over evil. You don't know the power of the dark side. And lastly, outlaws live in a world of fear of the mysterious. So those are major ideals, major modern ideals, except for the last two. The second to last one is a quote by Darth Vader. And the last one is the motto of the Lone Ranger, taking you way back, the Lone Ranger. And if you want to go to my mix later, the song God Only Knows by the Beach Boys is essentially the combination. It's so much more, but it's really there's one true God. Love is all you need. And gosh, what's the third one? I think it's just those two ideas. But the really romantic stuff, the really like vital stuff in our culture, they're modernist principles, right? So what I'm talking about tonight, even though I don't want to say it too much because nobody wants to talk about postmodernism, is what, you know, the generation that I grew up in, right? And how even if you grow up in that type of era with difficulty, with ambiguity, you know, you can make your way towards a sincere life where you care about other people. There's no, you know, higher or lower. I'm merely trying to use modernism to point out, and to really provide some relief for postmodernism, because a lot of people don't understand it. So this age is characterized by an increase in cynicism or irreverence in the face of those desperate and failed attempts to abandon our own true natures for social ideals. One of the first insights I had coming to Canando just a few months into sitting regularly was that self-criticism or self-promotion were both symptoms of a fragile ego. Paths to redemption are very scant whenever you head in that direction. And so while there's abundant evidence available, if you'd like to dismiss this as an age of decadence, we have to consider our children. If we love our descendants, then we need to continue to care about the world they will inherit. And so for me, and I know for many of you, to keep working towards the Dharma, towards the truth, no matter how ragged that gets, even if you're the biggest loser, you got to keep going. And the immediate reaction is often, you know, in my mind at least, is evil's winning. Evil is winning. Save yourself. That's where you start. And you don't need to necessarily come up in a tradition like Zen if you're committed to starting again. But that's what we do. That's our practice. And I would submit that that's what Beck does with his music. And so that's why I sent you that list. And I hope you listen to it. Because beyond his immense intellect, he had a heart behind the facade it took so long for people to recognize. And we all do. And it's through our virtue that we show it. I'd like to stop and I have a lot more, but if there's any questions, if someone has any sort of question, I'd like to just take a minute or so and open it up, if that's okay, Bonnie.
Yeah, sure. I see Dave has a question.
Travis, just a sort of mechanical question. It appeared to me when I tried to look at your playlist that, in fact, I would have to have a subscription to Apple Music in order to listen to it. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. I think you can preview it. And then if you're on Flock, you can find that think Vanessa did a Spotify version as well. And unfortunately, we live in a digital corporate oligarchy, right? No offense to anyone out there, but I'm happy to share it with you later if you'd like, Dave.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something. That, as far as I could tell, the preview was all that I could do without actually subscribing.
Okay. Yeah, and a few words about the mix. I made it chronological, and what I really tried to do was have songs from most of the 20th century and into the 21st century. I'm going to get into, you know, the roots of Beck's music here in a little bit. But, you know, he's a guy who, is really grounded in the blues. But he's also a postmodern, poster child in a way. And, if you listen through that, it's 2 hours. So it's, I don't expect anyone to listen to it all, but, you'll see how he's moves from irony to sincerity.
Megan has a question.
Megan.
What do you mean by modernity and postmodernity?
Sure. Thanks, Megan. Modernity is a time that includes the latter part of the 19th century and all the way up until and through the 1960s. It's a broad era, but as I just defined it, it contains several generations. By the time it had ended in the late 1960s, it had been four or five generations. It's characterized by a idea that we're making social progress. It has faith in science as the most objective truth that we know. And it spawned something that I may refer to in the future called scientism. And one of the books that was really formative to me, I'll just kind of show this, is Karl Popper, The Open Society and Its Enemies. This is an author that lived through World War II, and you know, and afterwards, having seen the atrocities of World War II, had very, very strong views about humanity. And one of the professors I was studying with at the time, this was about 20 years ago, said, you know, she put it in my hand because she learned that I was reading Kierkegaard, right? She put it in my hand and she said, you need to read this. And then I got to about page 50. This is where I got the message. Popper says to abandon our reason is to abandon our humanity. And that's why I'm talking tonight about this, the new sincerity, you know, trying to combine the heart with the intellect, which, you know, incidentally is in the most ancient Buddhist teachings. And, you know, there's the metaphor of the bird with two wings, wisdom on one side and compassion on the other. Thank you.
I actually have a question, Travis. So you mentioned the redeeming qualities of Homer Simpson, and that image stuck in my mind. So I was wondering, in your life, if you've ever come across someone or come across people where their faults are really obvious, you know, they rub you the wrong way. But if you look, like with Homer Simpson and his caring for his family, you can find that one sincere redeeming quality in a person that has many faults, and how that changes the way that you actually relate to them.
Wow. That's all of us, right? Yeah, that's all of us. You know, that's why the that's why I wanted to talk about the blues and talk about country, talk about cowboys tonight, you know, because it's that simple. And, you know, if we're not willing to see the good in people, and we're not willing to show up for people, then, you know, sometimes we can't make it. But as much as possible, if we can show up for people, we should. Because everybody's got that light in them. Thank you.
Thanks, Travis.
If you don't mind, I'll go ahead and talk about Beck a little bit.
I think Brenda has a question.
Oh, okay.
That first, and then.
Hey, thank you, Travis.
Hey, Brenda. Yeah.
Hi.
I see you barely. You're in the dark. Yeah.
I don't know what happened. I was just in the light, but then it just got dark here. Hang on.
I think the sunset or something.
Let's try that.
There you go.
Hi. The sunset. Hi. Or computer readjusted. Hi. I was wondering how. Thank you for your talk. It was lovely. Really. It stretches my mind in all dimensions. the interesting different references. I appreciate that. How do you think that Zen practice does that? What you're saying, helping to move from irony, cynicism to sincerity. How does that happen? Any ideas?
Well, you know, we talk about Taoism a lot, I think. At least I know you have some interest in that. And there's an expression that Xiang Yin put that you might recall, and it says, "There's no use for artificial discipline. For move as I will, I manifest the ancient Tao." And at this level, we're beyond anxiety. We can't make a mistake. So we live and we die. And we suffer. We go through all the things of being human, right? And that's what I mean about sincerity. It's not just sincerity to other people, it's sincerity to yourself, you know? And why not? I mean, this is our activity.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for the questions. So if anyone else has questions, I'd love to answer them now. I can also make liner notes to that mix and send them out to all of you. So I don't need to provide commentary to the actual songs, but. I'll just go on then. If that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
And if you need to drop off, that's fine. Beck Hansen is a musician that grew up in Los Angeles in the 70s. And he had a young mom who was a performance artist. She had been in Andy Warhol's scene and Beck dropped out of school very young. And his music spans a lot of genre now, but it's his country blues roots that I'm going to focus mainly on. It's an interesting lens because it allows us to so clearly see the decline of postmodernism and the reemergence of modern ideals. Not to replace postmodernism, but to sit alongside it in an age of sincerity. I think that's the true growth that we all yearn for. Cultural growth, self-improvement, self-actualization. These are new wavy terms, but I think I'm using them appropriately here. And, you know, artists don't really have control over their initial celebrity. So a lo-fi song that a 20-year-old recorded with a drum machine and a slide guitar and then forgot about it for a few years. I'm going to just sing it so you hear it. But I'm going to put the song on in my left ear. Here we go. All right. This is the first verse. In the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey, butane in my veins, so I'm out to cut the junkie with the plastic eyeballs, spray paint the vegetables, dog food stalls with the pantyhose, kill the headlights and put it in neutral. Stock car flaming with the loser and the cruise control. Baby's in Reno with the vitamin D. Got a couple of couches. Sleep on the love seat. I won't bore you with the rest of it, but there's an Evel Knievel sample.
What's the name of the song?
That's Loser. That's the big hit song.
Dying Paradigm.
Right on. And you might recall there's an Evel. Yeah, I went to Beck concert last year, and I was like, wow, yeah. But there's an Evel Knievel sample within the track at the end that says, "I'm a driver, I'm a winner, things are going to change, I can feel it." And this is my big example of irony, right? It's taking things that don't go together. And making them into something that's almost like befuddling to people. You know, if you have a modern orientation, you might hear that and go, what? It's like stream of consciousness. That's nonsense. It doesn't mean anything. But if you listen deeper, in the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey. I mean, you can dig into that. I can go back to the ideals I just listed, and I can go through the theory of natural selection, and it says it all, right? It just depends what you want to pay attention to. So it's a blues song, and there's depth to it, and there's heart, and there's mind. But that depth is covered up in a sort of layer of irony and self-consciousness. And so if you listen through his 30-year career now, you'll hear that irony and self-consciousness like go away and the heart come out and the sincerity shine. Jerry Seinfeld, you know, he has a new TV show that I saw over the weekend called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And you might know it. It's a show that combines Seinfeld's interests. It's convenient for him. It's well named because it's about the length of time you would ever want to be stuck in a car with a deeply committed ironist. And it's as though, at least professionally, you know, he's channeled his deep allergy to gooey emotions, which to me are the raw material of, at least in a modern sense, personal growth. But the episode I saw, I've only seen a few episodes. The episode I saw was with Jim Carrey. And so y'all know Jim Carrey. I'm trying to really make this as mainstream as possible. And so he shows up with a 1976 Lamborghini Countach, Tahiti blue with white interior. And in defining his guest with this garish but amazing and wonderful machine, he's putting, you know, Carrie, who's charming but overbearing, as you know, slightly on the defensive. And Carrie is sort of perched on the white leather passenger seat. And there's this roar coming from this 12-cylinder engine behind his head, and they're filming, right? And on the drive, Jim Carrey turns to Seinfeld really, really earnestly and says, "I just finished a 21-day cleanse. I'm leaving for a silent retreat in Berlin tomorrow." And Seinfeld says something like, "Yeah, that won't be a problem for you at all, staying silent." Yeah. Customary sarcasm. And there's more banter. But then Carrie interjects, "You know about the relative and the absolute, right? The relative is the things you relate to, and the absolute is the truth of consciousness being everything." And so you can go see it, maybe can send a link, but there's this look that Carrie normally gives where the charm briefly leaves him, you know, and he gets real, his jaw gets slack. He kind of gazes intently out in space, you know, that empty, I'm all out of meaning look. Great late modernist look, right? And he's the best at it. But he wasn't giving that at the moment. He's still asking Seinfeld kind of a guarded question, kind of like fidgety. And so Seinfeld kind of just like looks like, you know, he's uncomfortable for a second or two. And he says, "So how do we relate that to the three levels of pulp and orange juice?" So there's just layers of irony, right? These are masters, the probably two most successful comedians in postmodernism, right? And Carrie turns to me and says, "There's no pulp. No matter how much pulp they tell you there is, it's an illusion. There are sensations. There is," and Seinfeld cuts him off. They get out of the Lamborghini, go in the diner, and he says, "But what are those little bits in the juice? I feel them." And they walk into the diner, and they begin to talk about Andy Kaufman, who is another famous postmodern comedian, some would say anti-comedian. And there's this scene in 1999's Man on the Moon, where in real life, Andy Kaufman, you know, he's a performance artist, but he also like is an actor on the show Taxi. He goes on late night shows. But in this highly adapted movie that Jim Carrey starred in, there's a scene where he tells his girlfriend, "I'm a bad person." And he's laying in bed, and he looks really depressed. And he says, and she says, this is Courtney Love. That's his girlfriend in the film. "You are a complicated person." And then he says, "You don't know the real me." And then she says, "There isn't a real you." And then he says, "Oh yeah, I forgot." And then they chuckle. And that's the era that I grew up in, right? But later in this episode, the comedian's in cars getting coffee, so they're just about out of the diner, And Carrie turns to Seinfeld and he says, "Remember that scene in Field of Dreams? In the end, out in the cornfields? Let's play catch. Just give me that one moment." And that connects. That connects with Jerry Seinfeld, finally. And he lets down his guard and he says, "Yeah, yeah, that's it. What I wouldn't give to have a simple catch with my dad." So y'all have to drop off. That's fine. But I'm going to talk about Beck in a little more detail. He's a poster boy of the slacker generation that I grew up in. I graduated in 1994, and the year I graduated high school, there was the song Creep by Radiohead, Thom Yorke, and Loser, Beck Hansen. And if you had to distinguish between the two, Thom was the more isolated. Thom was the more possessed of the two. He was the British primary school kid. And Beck was the more discarded or damned, the castaway. And 30 years later, lo and behold, they're the two most successful songwriters of what is generally an underrepresented and dismissed generation. They've won every big award in their profession collectively. And so, you know, it's like I look at Thom Yorke like he's John Lennon and Beck's Elvis Presley, you know, and it's culturally so different than, you know, my ancestors, you know, one or two generations past me that I literally can't even really communicate culturally, right? I know that there are modernist ideals that are important. I know that. And these things at the same time, if you look at through the cultural context of how we should be and how we should relate to each other, we have an increased sensitivity and sensibility that comes from 40, 50 years of experience. And so when you listen to the mix, you notice that Beach Boys date 66, and then go to David Bowie's Starman 72. That's 6 years. That's not that much time, right? That was a seismic shift, right? And there are people that didn't ever make that jump, you know, and didn't ever want to try to understand the other side. And, you know, what can I do? I can reach back, right? Westerns were the most popular genre of movie in Hollywood through the 1960s. And Beck was born on that, you know, off Hollywood Boulevard in 1970. And, you know, I love Blazing Saddles, but by the 70s, no stars were riding off the sets. But the sets were still lying around, discarded. And he felt that way, too. I think one of the first tracks I have is Johnny Mercer's first big production hit, a Bing Crosby song called "I'm an Old Cowhand" from the Rio Grande. And, you know, it goes like, I'll at least sing the first verse for you. "I'm an old cowhand from the Rio Grande, but my legs ain't bowed and my cheeks ain't tan. I'm a cowboy who never saw a cow, never roped a steer, 'cause I don't know how. Sure ain't fixin' to start in now. Yippee-yi-yo-ki-yay. And it goes on from there. And the next track is I Ride the Range in My Ford V8, which when I crossed over from Mono Lake over Sonora Pass, you know, still Ford V8s, you know, half the vehicles coming the other way were Ford V8s. So the one that gets me, and this is one of the revisionist lyrics that comes much later in the 50s, because back then people would just, they just revised their songs to keep them current, was, and the old Bar X is just a barbecue. The old Bar X is just a barbecue. Wow. you know, it's more like a fad diet of pop music. There's naivety to it, to my ears. But it's optimistic. It's lighthearted. It's not afraid to be buffoonish. Because that's a big no-no in a postmodern circle, right? To be the fool. Beck, you know, in his career of songwriting, even early on, it consisted of ironic, hip, hyper-aware, or clever wordplay. It was self-referential. It wasn't quite coherent enough to be cynical, but it was deeply absurdist. And it was always blues-based, always. Always anchored in that sort of American tradition. But it was at the same time, product, time, and place, the seamy underbelly of Hollywood. I really need to play this song because I won't be able to sing it to you. Really do it justice. Let's see. This is one of his most lyrical songs. Oh, I can't pull it up. Well, I'm just going to wing it, okay? This is the song Lazy Flies. Out in the mangroves, the minor birds cry. In the shadows of sulfur, the trawlers drift by. They're chewing dried meat in a house of disrepute. The dust of opiates and syphilis patients on brochure vacations. Fear has a glare that traps you like searchlights. The Puritans stare. Their souls are fluorescent. The skin of a robot vibrates with pleasure. Matrons and gigolos carouse in the parlor. I'll let you listen to the end later. One of the ironies that grew into the music of the late 90s when I was in college was that music was quite often bright, had major keys. It's the sort of things that I would have heard in church when I was a kid. And at the same time, they were paired with lyrics of alienation or subversive cleverness. But from the beginning, Beck started adapting the blues, first more lo-fi, exposed Delta blues, and then gradually a more country blues sound. Most of his songs are what I would term country blues. And country blues, at least when it's good, it's honest. And it says something about our lives, our existence. And that's something that would make Kierkegaard smile. And that is something that a real cowboy would relate to. You know, a cowboy is a modern icon. He relates to his environment directly. His environment might be rugged or harsh, but the environment doesn't have a malevolence to it. His relationship with the natural environment is intimate, and his success is to an extent due to favorable conditions. The cowboy is silent unless the circumstances require speech, then he says what he means. The terms of the cowboy's engagement are defined up front. His success and failure are understandable. He may be technically astute, but he dwells beyond sophisticated social, i.e. political systems. He has no need to gain favor in another. He works as hard as needed, but usually for a little money. I have one more song. Let's see if I can pull it up here. And then I'm done. You don't have to listen to me sing anymore like a sad cowboy. Till there's nothing left to say. Wrote it all down into something that couldn't be said. Tore it all down and buried me underneath the waves. Can we start it all over again this morning? I let down my defenses this morning. I was just you and me this morning. I fought all my guesses this morning. Won't you show me the way it could have been? That was it. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Travis. but thank you, Travis, for reminding us that sincerity can be found in unlikely places and in our popular culture all around.
And I do encores, so stick around if you want.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.